I trail straight Killerville, dog, 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 dog. By Trail Straight Killerville, dog, 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 dog.
Thank you. We are back. Thank you, thank you, thank you very much. Another Live from Fayetteville Friday. I'm the one and only Paul Masson, and I'm joined by Mr. J. Trillanoid Tracks. Might join us on, later on for topics. He texted me about something about NASA doubling up orders and stuff. You know, that's crazy. So we got Barry Benson on tonight. I told him, give us 7:05. We'll be ready for him. How you doing tonight, Mr. J?
All right, man. You know, just keeping things moving.
That's what's up. That's what's up. We're going to have a couple juicy topics for y'all later tonight. We're going to talk about the best and the worst diss records of all time. And we're going to talk about what Scarface said about artists, unsigned rappers leaving streaming platforms. Anything you want to shout out before we get started, though?
You know, this day is actually DJ Rock Raider's birthday. Would have been his, not sure exactly what, but you know, he passed away some time ago. So, you know, just kind of shout out to him.
That's what's up, man. You see MC Lyte's about to drop an album soon too, right?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. You know, I've heard a couple things from a couple singles that she dropped maybe 2 years ago or sometime between 2 and 5 years ago, and she's never sounded better. So if it's on that level, on that type of time, definitely I'm looking forward to it.
Well, you know how I'm thinking, right? I'm thinking like, all right, she gonna have a single, gotta review that on the show. And I'm thinking like, you know, I interviewed MC Lyte long time ago, man. I'm sure we can make it happen again. You know, I interviewed Guru back in the days. Rest in peace to Guru. It was him and Solar. They were doing a show in Denver. I ain't gonna lie, man. It was one of my least memorable interviews because they seemed like they really didn't want to do the interview. They was just ready to get to the show or you know, get it over with or whatnot. But yeah, MC Lyte, you know how I'm thinking. And I mean, we got a bunch of interviews still lined up. Well, we got next week we got Illa G. Then a week after, no, matter of fact, my bad. Next week we got Supreme the Elohim. Week after we got Illa G, and then we got Smooth the Hustler the day after that. That's gonna be a nice little three-interview run right there. We still got Edgar Allan Flow. We still got Mickey Fax. We still got Cayenne the Lion King. Am I saying it right, Cayenne?
Yes, Cayenne the Lion King.
Cayenne the Lion King. You know, I'll be butchering the names on these music reviews, so I don't want to butcher the name. And then we got Bishop the Omega, and and now we got none other than our guest tonight. Let me tell y'all a little bit about him. He's been in radio since 1991. The Source magazine voted his radio show one of the most influential radio shows in the country. He's worked with cats like Organized Confusion, DJ Shadow, Peanut Butter Wolf, Mint Condition, and the great Barry White. Let's bring in Barry Benson.
What's up,
good, man? I'm doing good. Let's get you on that big screen. We got to get you on the big screen. There you go.
Okay. What's happening, everybody? How we doing?
We good. Right, I got my man, Mr. J, with me. He's our hip-hop historian.
Mr. J, what's happening with you, man? You good?
Good. How about yourself?
Can't complain.
Right.
So we was looking up, we're doing our research. You know, I want to start here, man. College. So You ran the radio show in college. How did that get started? And how did it like get to the point where the Source started recognizing your radio show?
It was my junior year of college at University of California, Riverside. And I remember I was also trying to pledge my fraternity at the time, Alpha Phi Alpha. Shout out there to all the AA Phi in the house. And at the time, I told the program director I want to do a hip-hop show. He goes, well, hip-hop? What's that? Because all the other shows are just funk shows. He goes, this is 1986. He's like, hip-hop's not going to last. And why do you want to do that? All right? So he goes, I'll give you a 30-day trial. So I went to the record store and I got three records. I got Divine Sounds, That's What People Do for Money. I got Run DMC, It's Like That, back with Sucker MCs. and I had 5 minutes of funk for Houdini. And I literally played the instrumental, the bonus beats, and everything over and over and over for like an hour. And the phones are ringing. People are like, yo, this is great. This is great. This is great. But one dude called me and he goes, I love your show, man. But you know what? You need some other records. And so I was like, he's like, well, you need to, you know, I'm from New York and I manage this artist. You need to come to my house. I said, come to your house. I said, no, bro, hold on, man. He's like, you know, and pick up some other vinyl from me. So I go, well, look, how about this? I'll roll out front. I'm not going to go into your house, bro. And so he goes, cool. So the next week later, I go to his house. He gives me a full box. Little did I know this guy was actually, I'll get around to that. So he ends up telling me, yo, go play this stuff. So I go home. I'm putting stuff on my turntable. And I'm like, Bismarcky, you know, you know, Vapors, Prism Records. I'm like, what is that? I don't know. You know, Big Daddy Kane Raw 12-inch. All of these records, EPMD, It's My Thing, You Back With Your Customer, like all these joints. So I start playing these things, and my show just got bigger and bigger and bigger over time. And to the point to where all of a sudden, The Source, the Gavin magazine, started recognizing me, because in here in L.A., you only had K-Day back then, and it was commercial, the hip-hop show, and the first hip-hop commercial radio station in the country. And then you had King Gizmo and Easy Mike at Pomona College. They went on to produce Beastie Boys' Paul's Boutique, right? Okay. And then you had my show, Rock Berry's Funky Dope Maneuver, KUCR. That was it on the West Coast for about, honestly, close to almost 10 years. And so I just got to know to write it because there was nothing else. So all the artists would come from New York, do the Fresh Fest, for example, and then they would all come out to do the Fresh Fest, which also was at what we call the Orange Grove, the Orange Fairgrounds in Riverside. And so all those artists would all of a sudden come to my show. So then I started getting notoriety from the acts too. So that's how it all happened. So I got to recognize George Hinojosa, who to this day is the manager for Ice-T. That was the one that heard me and was like, he lived with his mom in Riverside, gave me all the first vinyl, had the first hip hop record pool. And he's the one that really got me started. So
that's crazy. And so you were kind of like traditional radio nowadays. You was only playing three records over and over again at first. Like they do nowadays.
Word, exactly.
But he gave you the heaters. He gave you, I mean, EPMD, Big Daddy Kane, Bismarcky. That's crazy. All right, so it says you did radio promotions for Disney, and it was Hollywood Records. How did that come about, man? And what artists were you like working on radio for Disney?
So at the time I'm working, I was working for a wine company, being a liquor rep, Young's Market Company, you know, with wearing a suit and tie, you know, going and like selling wine. I was like wine into grocery store chains. I'm like, this cannot be my life. And this is what I got a degree for. It paid well, but I'm like, I wasn't passionate about it. Still had my radio show. Long story short, I look in the Source magazine and they had a one ad for a job that said, looking for a director of mix show for Walt Disney's new record rap label, Hollywood Basic. I'm like, okay, what is this? I'm like already, I'm a Disney fan already. And then I'm like a rap label. So I call and I forget how I even got the interview, but I did. And I got interview with a guy named Dave Funkenklein. Dave Funkenklein had a radio show on, also on college radio at the University of Colorado Boulder. He went on afterwards and worked for Red Alert Productions with Russell Simmons, Red Alert, and whatnot. And then they end up helming him, Peter Paterno, who is still this day Axl Rose and Dr. Dre's lawyer, was basically the president of Hollywood Records. So I get this job, don't know how, and they're giving me a corporate card. And like, now we're going to go and sign this group. The first group you're going to promote is this group that we went to an actual prison and recorded in Rahway, New Jersey, called the Lifers Group. Instead of having fake gangsters, we're going to get real gangsters who are in jail doing time. So that was my first record, my intro into it. After that, you know, they said, we're going to sign this other group that basically is called Organized Confusion, also out of Queens, New York. And that was the second group we had, which had, you know, my first record was Who Stole My Last Piece of Chicken, back with Fudge Pudge, which became like a major, you know, underground hip hop hit at like college radio stations, and that was the start of my career.
So most people probably don't know Organized Confusion was on a label that was under Walt Disney.
Yes.
And that's crazy. Like, yep. It's crazy to think Walt Disney would even sign somebody like Organized Confusion. It really is.
It is crazy. It's crazy because we got away with a lot. I mean, in terms of, they didn't really know. We signed the Booyah Tribe, if you remember them.
Oh, too. Yeah.
And they're all rolling.
They're like Mexican gangsters, right?
Yeah. They were
Samoan.
Yeah. Samoan.
Correct. Samoan. Yeah. That's right.
So it's crazy. We signed Raw Fusion, which was Money B and DJ Fuse and Digital Underground. We were trying to sign RBX, but let's just say Suge and Death Row had some other ideas. That's a that's a whole other story in itself. I don't even know if I want to get into that. But yeah, you know, but for close to 3 years, man, we had a little thing. We got, you know, we were the first person to start DJ Shadow. He did a first remix with us. Peanut Butter Wolf, who now has Stone Stone Records, he started his first remix when he had his group Peter Wolf and Charisma. So people don't realize that Hollywood Basic really was a launching pad for real hip hop. Major Force, which was one of the first, the Japanese hip hop labels. All basically, we'd also distribute some of their stuff. So it was a good two, 3 years over there.
I want to let Mr. J get some questions in as well.
Absolutely.
You were saying you were one of the first DJs on the West Coast. Can you kind of describe the scene, you know, how it kind of looked at the time?
You know what, at that time, funk drives the West Coast, right? The West Coast is a funk. So G-Funk came out of funk. Gang culture and hip-hop culture and funk all sort of coalesced around the same thing. You had places like, you had Uncle Jam's Army, which was a major promotion company back in the early 80s that were promoting these big shows that were having artists like Egyptian Lover and, you know, the World Class Wrecking Crew, Dre's first group, and Toddy T. And the scene back then was more techno hip hop because it was closer to funk. So that was more palatable for kids in Compton and Linwood and Watts. Out where I'm from, the Inland Empire, Pomona, that's sort of what you were, that was what you're into. So the extension of hip hop really came from melodic hip hop back in the day. It wasn't like New York style. That took a good, that was about the six, like I said, I started 86. That didn't really catch on to like 87, 88, you know, when you're looking at like LL Bigger and Deffer. But like early on, that was the real scene in LA. Because, you know, it was breakdance on the West Coast. On the West Coast, you had pop locking, you know, like big time. Like, that's what it was. And that was an extension of funk. So the extension, but that was pretty much it was. Skating rinks were a big part of the beginning of hip hop. Mostly NWA, Prince, all these guys got their start like World on Wheels, roller skating rink. Run DMC's first appearance in California was at a roller skating rink, World on Wheels, right here in the hood. But it'd be funny because the DJs had played mainly funk. You know, before that, Cameo, Barcades, things of that nature. It wasn't New York. So it was crazy how at one point New York came in and found its way, but it had to be the right kind of records that were making that kind of sound because it had to still be melodic and funky. And that's why G-Funk, you know, became so prominent. And it's still, you know, you look at right now, right around me, and I live right here in South LA, here in Los Angeles, you can't walk by. I probably every 5 or 10 minutes can hear the Kendrick Lamar Munchin' on the Beat latest diss track playing. Why? That track. More than anything. It's a representative of the West Coast.
You worked at Hollywood Records, A&M Records, and Rhino. What are the kind of differences between labels? What were the things that you kind of noticed going into different?
Okay, and then one more label I worked at too was Interscope Records too. That was my last label job, and I was the Apple Music rep there. So what were the differences between them? Well, obviously Hollywood Basic was just core hip hop. They didn't even know what to do with us, like at the end of the day. That was early experimental, like really letting artists be artists. You know, one other group that we had at Hollywood was a group called Zimbabwe Legit. Funk and Klein wanted to sign an actual group from Africa. you know, and, you know, and have them rap in their native Zulu language and stuff, which, you know, was like, wow, dude, you know, how are we getting away with this, right? To A&M Records, which was a traditional R&B label, you know, that was Barry White, that was Sheryl Crow, that was Sting, but we had a rap imprint there called, that ran by my buddy named Evan Forster, and it was called Tough Break. So we had a guy named Dred Scott, had a record called Check the Rhyme, which actually was kind of a dope record. Task Force, these guys out of Philly, managed by Charlie Mack, who's Will Smith's manager for a long time. But that was a short-lived thing. After about 2 years, the president of A&M was like, yeah, this rap thing, I'm not really feeling. We made more money off Barry White and Sheryl Crow. So then Rhino came up as a result of, which was a catalog label. Well, a friend of mine I worked at Hollywood Records with, she goes, Barry, you need to come over here and like do your black thing. I'm like, okay, what does that mean? So she's like, you need to take the Elektra Warner, the Elektra catalog, the Warner catalog, and any of the black acts, you need to do best stuff and compilations, and you need to pay these dudes again, and you need to get record new songs with them and add them on, blah, blah, blah. So the difference there, I was kind of like being able to sort of preserve classic hip hop in terms of doing things like P-Rock, CL Smooth, we had the Far Side Best Of, De La Soul recently re-released, the project I did back in 2000, De La Soul Live at Tramps, featuring like one of the first appearances of like Mos Def. So I had the opportunity to sort of like archive what hip hop was in the like late to the mid to late 90s, what it was back in the 80s, because we had sort of made such a shift. So that was a label because it was such a big catalog label. And, you know, we were uberly successful in that space doing that with hip hop, in terms of, and also paying artists back royalties. If they were recouped, they got some money back from us. So that was a good situation to be able to do that for artists, especially in the hip hop side that have gotten pimped by, you know, taking big advances and, you know, not even reading their contracts and all that stuff. And then Interscope was like, okay, now we're in the, I worked in the mobile space, the beginning of the ringtone space after Rhino. And that was sort of my intro into, I guess you could say, the digital space. Cause, my boss at Rhino said, he held up a BlackBerry in 99 and said, the future of music is going to be on your phone. I looked at him like, man, get out of here, bro. What are you talking about? you're gonna be able to buy it and everything. And he's like, Barry, if you don't, you see what's happening right now with LimeWire and Napster, if you don't get out of this right now, you're going to be going back to college, getting a master's degree, and getting back in your field of political science. And I made that switch, went to Interscope. And fortunately, that was a great situation because at the time, Common was there. We did B, you know, we did... we had, my God, Pussycat Dolls were there on the other side. We had Snoop doing the Blue Carpet Treatment record, you know. So I was the Apple guy, and so that was the beginning of the download business. So I went from the CD business at Rhino for 9 years, selling, you know, I could think of a compilation and we could do 100,000 like with my eyes closed. To all of a sudden now we're in the business of like now trying to monetize digital music. And selling music for what was it, 99 cents, and what, 129 for select groups, and going up to Apple and convincing them how to basically place these songs on play. It's the beginning of playlisting, right? It's really what it was. And so that was the difference. So I've kind of watched the, you know, I've started in vinyl in the 80s to the core CD business also throughout the 90s to the mobile ringtone business, trying to pimp Beyonce ringtones to Verizon and Sprint. And ringbacks and wallpapers to the to digital downloads to now playlisting. So that's sort of like I've kind of watched the evolution over like I could just say four generations of where the music is in terms of how it's been distributed.
You touched on a little bit of that working in radio promotion and digital sales and digital marketing and A&R, which is kind of, you know, a lost art. So we don't really have no A&Rs at record labels. What are your thoughts on the kind of the changing landscape?
You know, my thoughts are, me and Paul talk about this, it seems like all the time.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. I'll say this. It's a great time for music. There is lots of great music in the hip hop space. There are so many artists out there that, you know, Paul and I come across this all the time. The problem is there's 100,000 records that come out a day, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, those artists are just sort of like, okay, Barry, Paul, help us. But there's only so much that we can even do in this space. It's in terms of the creative side, I mean, young people, I think, are at a place to where their mindset is more of what it was, I think, in the 80s and the golden age of hip hop, that whole 86 to 91 era, and even after, in terms of the creativity that is still out there with underground hip hop. Now, we're not talking about anything commercialized or radio or trap or anything like that, but it's a weird space because you have to really be a lover and a connoisseur of hip hop to know where to go and find what that is, whether it's SoundCloud, whether it's, whatever place might be where you're, whether it's Snapchat a few years ago, but for younger people. So I think music discovery is at an all-time high. I don't think that's going to change. You know, if you're a fan of a sound big time, you're going to find it out because you're not a passive listener. One thing I was doing also, which I didn't really touch on, and I probably didn't touch about my bio as much, is I was working for a company as a consultant that Apple hired out to do study what we call human behavior analysis. In other words, looking at the AI of what they're recommending, the search engine's recommending as a song. If you love Drake, you're going to love Kendrick. And basically going in and literally filling in a Dropbox explaining why that's not the case, right? And so now I think you have these sorts of search engines so sort of fine-tuned based on the fact that if you are a real fan of music, it's going to come to you that way. And I think that's probably the only thing I really like about AI. But that's where I think where it's really, you know, for people that are like, you know, screw this, I'm tired of radio. I'm tired of trying to sit and listen to the same record every few minutes because we know radio is pretty much driven by advertising. That's kind of where I think it is right now, for the most part. The one thing that's missing, though, is seeing artists, shows, these festivals, I think, they've gotten too exclusive in terms of trying to expose new artists. A lot of the ones that Paul and I work with, I get more artists asking about how can I get out there and be seen. Like, taking care of my YouTube and all that stuff is great, but they're looking for booking agents. They're looking to figure out how they can get into local clubs. You know, the things we talked about earlier about having, you know, the roller skating rink back in the day, the small club where you can do, you know, freestyle sessions, like all that stuff, you know, with Project Blood, where Farside got started here in LA, a vitamin store that just did artists going just freestyle, you know, and those things are lost. And
the grassroots promotion.
Grassroots, yes. Yeah.
Correct.
And we had DJ Chuck T on recently, and he was saying that we got to get back to that because we're talking about trying to get back to physical product more and make it more exclusive. So we got to get back to the street teams and just the flyers, the posters, stickers everywhere. I got another question for you. How did you end up on the Big Daddy Kane Unsung documentary?
Okay. So this goes back to my, there's a gentleman by the name of Frank Williams, who is a frat brother of mine. Frank has been a producer ever since he was in college of shows, a lot of BET shows, Who Shot Tupac, recently the Freaknik documentary. Actually.
Okay.
It's done by him. You probably want to actually have him on this. But Frank called me up. He's like, hey, Barry, man, you're over there at Rhino. And, you know, I know you did the Big Daddy Kane project. You did the Best of Zapp and Roger. You've done a whole, you know, Best of Keith Sweat, Anita Baker, blah, 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 blah. But we're going to do a show on Big Daddy Kane, Unsung. And he's like, I need you to come on here to speak from the guy who, from the catalog side. And that's how that happened. And it's funny how that show honestly ran for like 10 years. And I had my family's originally from Montgomery, Alabama. I remember my aunt called my mom and said, I was cooking in the kitchen and I heard Barry's voice on TV. And I said, look, there he is. And so anyway, that's how it came. So shout out to Frank, P. Frank Williams, who is really the leading sort of African-American, you know, documentary of our culture and hip hop culture and Black music culture for that.
Yeah, my guy, Stranger the Great, he sent me the link. He's like, yo, is this that cat Barry Benson you was talking about? I watched it. I was like, yep, that's him.
I got another one too.
Uh-huh. Me and Roker were talking the other day, man. We was talking about your plan. You know, you pitched the app. A lot of people don't know. Like, most people, they just want Spotify. But you be pitching the Apple Music editorials, Pandora Music editorials, and Amazon. Do you think you're ahead of the curve with your plan?
Yes. I'm definitely ahead of the
curve. We were saying that, too.
I was ahead of the curve again because of David Dorn. Shout out to him. He's still at Apple. He was the one who held up BlackBerry. He was my boss at Rhino. And yeah. I'm ahead of the plan mainly because of him and a gentleman by the name of Gary Stewart, rest his soul, who Steve Jobs hired as his catalog guy way back in the day once Rhino got sold to Warner's. And both of them said the same thing to me. They said, Barry, you know what? Your job right now is to keep learning what's next in this business because it's only going to go forward and it's going to go quick. The technology is going to go quick. What people are consuming is going to go quick. And so for me, you know, that's, you know, sort of like how I apply to, you know, when I left Interscope, having Matthew Knowles call me up right away and be like, hey, man, you're a black dude in digital. Let me have you consult for me. Ghazi Shimi, who now runs Empire Records. I basically started with Ghazi, you know, before he even got Empire. He was in Ingrooves. He's like, Barry, you're the black dude who knows all this digital stuff. I need for you to help me. I'm like, help you? This dude's almost a billionaire right now, you know? But it was really, you know, a niche. And I tell people all the time, I just carved out a niche in this place of digital marketing, streaming, blah, blah, blah. And I worked the niche. And I tell anybody listening out there, whether you're an artist, whether you're an executive, I tell my 21-year-old daughter's about to graduate from Northwestern University, keep carving your niche out in every area and you will be successful in that space.
Yeah, you're really ahead of the curve with this Spotify climate the way it is. I've been saying I don't think Spotify is going to last like years ago, and just the way it's going now, I definitely feel like, you know, I've been validated on that, you know, and vindicated that that's not going to last. But we just hit the 30-minute mark and we still got some topics. So before you go, man, anything you want to shout out?
I want to shout out, again, like all my mentors out there. I mentioned George Hinojosa, Dave Funkin' Klein. If you don't know who he is, please Google Dave Funkin' Klein of Hollywood Basic, rest his soul. You know, want to shout out there, all KUCR, Louis Vandenberg for helping get me off the ground back in the day, the program director who said the show's not going to last. Ha ha. You know, and, you know, that's it. Just a shout out to my girl, Alexis. My daughter, Sasha, is graduating from Northwestern University next month. She's DJing her first party at the end of the year next month. So she's kind of
congratulations.
Thank you. And shout out to also Promo Pals, you know, Paul.
Appreciate it. It definitely shouts out to you because you, like a lot of people don't know, you the cat that set up the Lenny Williams interview for us. And, you know, I think that brought a lot of credibility to our show when we interviewed Lenny Williams because, you know, a lot of people's parents were making babies to Lenny.
Okay, well, it's my pleasure. If anybody else I can help you with, please let me know.
Well, we appreciate you coming on. Anytime you want to come on, man, please do, man. And make sure y'all follow Barry on Instagram at barry.benson.75, man.
That's good.
If y'all need Apple Music, Pandora, and Amazon editorials, I'm going to put his contact. Is it cool if I put your email in the comments so they can
go right ahead?
Okay, we're going to do that. We're going to make sure we're going to put your email in the comments so they can hit you up and whatnot, man.
Cool. Well, Paul, I appreciate it, man. And pleasure to meet you, my brother.
Definitely. Great to meet you.
All right, Barry, man. Enjoy that California weather, man.
Okay, guys. Have a great weekend. Peace.
All right. Peace. Well, that was a very good interview. I mean, damn, Barry's done a lot of things, yo. He's worked with a lot of people, man. A lot of names I heard shouted out there, man. But we about to get in some time. Who we got to? We got John Jones been tuning in. Peace, Barry. Thanks for what you done and do. He said earlier Dred Scott was dope. Can't hold it back. Nothing to lose. RIP Charisma and Samoan, this is a raid. We're talking about the Booyah tribe. and whatnot. So we about to get into a quick Dizzle break, and we're going to be right back.
Tropical drink.
Me and my team have never been link up. They're gonna be drink up. We sit and relax and have few glasses when there's things to think about. Like I'm nice with the boss when I tend to the bars and I'm not talking drink up. So tell the bartender that's tending the bar to please pass me a big cup up. And tell that waitress is waiting on us to put a little ice in it. Now watch the ice become weightless like the spaceships that I be sitting in. No waiting list, another waiting for that tropical twist. That'll take your taste buds. Now taste up. Now I insist it's the
drizzle.
Yeah, that's right. I really mean it. You could Dizzle too. Dizzle is a premium luxury liqueur mixed with agave, tequila, cognac, and orange liquor mango mix. Throw your Dizzle on ice and it's nice. If you want to order your very own bottle or bottles, go to DizzleBrand.com. We also got the Dizzle Brand merch, t-shirts, and more. I ain't getting no text back from Trillanoise, so it looked like me and you going to have to hold it down with these topics. We held it down last Friday with the Chuck T, and that was a very, very great interview. We still getting a bunch of traffic off of the post. Thanks to Chuck T schooling me on that Instagram collaborator thing. You familiar with that, Mr. J?
Yeah.
I didn't know much about how that worked.
It's definitely dope. I see a lot of the comments. I see a lot of traction still from that whole thing. And definitely posting it up where I can, different places, and still getting a lot of views and hearing a lot back from it. And people had a lot to say. Definitely artists had a lot to say about, you know, what they felt about, you know, different things about promotion and what they feel the artists should be doing and what they feel the DJs should be doing and record labels, so on and so forth. So I expect to hear a lot more even going forward.
I mean, they could get in their feelings, man, but like, I look at it. I mean, we just had Barry on. You heard what... You know, you heard his resume. We know Chuck T's resume. Shouts out to Vinny Dangerous Official Music for tuning in. He said, it's helped me grow on Instagram too. Link on my podcast to the main page. John Jones with another one. Yeah, like they could get in their feelings, man. But like, you know, the game is the game, man. You know, we don't make the rules of the game. You know, you just got to navigate through them, around them, or whatever.
I always say, play the game until you can change the game. You know?
All right, so.
What that looks like.
Let's get into the first topic. What is the best and worst diss records in hip-hop history? Of course, I'm going to have you start. You can start with your best or your worst. It really doesn't matter. I got a little list over here myself.
Some of my favorites. Real G's from Eazy-E. Dollars and Cents. Second Round Knockout. And the one that basically started this question and discussion for me was the one that Questlove said he didn't care for, which was the Tupac joint. So
oh, okay. Yeah, I saw that. He's taking a lot of slack on the internet for that. Like, so, okay. So what'd you think about that?
I just thought it was interesting because I'm like, okay, well, everybody's got their own, you know, their own feelings about it. I just felt like, you know, that was probably one of the hardest ones. The very hardest to me was No Vaseline, but I think that's one of the hardest ones because of what it started, you know what I mean? Or because of what they said it started, you know, whole East West thing or it was perpetuating. But with him, I guess he's looking at it from like a more, musical standpoint, like, it didn't really capture his imagination, but I think it captured the imaginations of a lot of people. You know what I mean? But it's just interesting that he would take that kind of, or have that take on that particular song. So,
I mean, I ain't gonna lie, that's not on my list of best, nor is it on my list of worst, you know, but I don't know. I mean, I don't really, did he say exactly? So what did he say why he didn't like it? He's exactly.
I didn't really get more into the specifics of it. Well, here's what the blurb basically said. It basically said, dude, you're rhyming over smooth jazz dinner music. Luther Vandross.
Oh, so it was the production. It was the production that he really wasn't feeling.
So, like I said, it was more musical for him than, I guess, the particular lyrics and how hard he was trying to get
it. With these modern day so-called battle records, is just the production. I mean, so that's your best. What's your worst?
I think Nicki Minaj, Bigfoot.
Is that what that's called, Bigfoot? I thought it was called Stupid Ho.
I think it's either or, but
is it? Oh, is it either or? Okay.
I'm not sure. I think it's and the other one would be the top one for me would be Hammer. Run, better run.
I see. He was on the list on Reddit. Yeah.
I remember he was trying to beef, for whatever reason. I guess, you know, that one line about that Jay spit, you know, I could lose 30 mil won't hurt me, you know. And he kind of talked about Hammer in that line, and Hammer came back and tried to answer. But, you know, that just wouldn't work. Nick Cannon, The Invitation. Anything with Nick Cannon is probably save for Gigolo. That's one of my little guilty pleasures is Gigolo.
I actually listened to that the other day. I think there's a lot worse diss records than the Nick Cannon one, because I actually listened to that the other day. He was trying hard, man. He was trying hard.
He had another one where he was like the whole thing. He was rapping like Slick Rick, and I can't even remember the name.
Oh, man.
Like he had did the whole dress up like Slick Rick or whatever. It wasn't good. Melly Mel,
Melly Mel's on my list.
That one's, you know, in 85 maybe that would have hit, but right now he needed to kind of step back. I don't even understand why he started that diss with Eminem in the first place. That don't make sense.
Yeah, I was telling Mr. Jones, who's tuning in, saying that any dude that's from the 80s that didn't even get any play in the 90s should not be trying to diss nobody in the 2020s. Melly Mel didn't even get no play in the 90s, man. He was done in the 80s.
I mean, the whole point is, you know, say you're a pioneer. You don't need to put yourself on that level. You know what I'm saying? It's not even a question of where your status is in the game. You know what I'm saying? You can't be judged on the level of somebody else who was selling records. You were there at the beginning of this.
Yeah, you were. Yeah,
you made your bones. It don't make sense to diss anybody who's been out. And same clown posse.
They were number one on the list I seen. Slim Anus.
Yeah, Slim Anus. I'm trying to remember what
we consider that hip hop though.
They're rappers. They're rappers.
Okay. I mean, okay.
You know what I mean?
See, I think that's the problem now, man. Everybody that raps were considering hip hop, man. But I thought hip hop had certain elements to it. And if you like all those elements are missing in your raps or just your everyday lifestyle culture, I'm like, I almost feel like rap culture should be separated from hip hop culture nowadays. You know what I'm saying? Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, I'm 100% with you. It's like I said, like we had the discussion last week, difference between rappers and MCs. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
A lot of rappers, very few MCs. It's commercial versus, you know, art. You know what I mean? So you know, and they're the cats that kind of, I don't know, they did a track with Method Man one time. They've done a track with some other, you know, actual hip hop artists.
You talking about Insane Clown Posse? Well, we know Tech N9ne blew up on their tour too. Tech N9ne opened up for them.
But I mean, they're almost like they just got a cultish.
I get it. They're almost like hip hop. They're just like got a gimmick.
Know. Yeah, the Juggalos and all that stuff. They have a very cultish following. So.
Oh yeah, they got a cult follower.
Yeah, big time. And the game track. I'm trying to find the game track.
Which one?
Eminem.
I don't even remember that. That's got to be one of the worst because I don't even remember it.
Yeah, man. And the whole point with him and that track is the problem is that he is he's trying to do basically what Snoop did by accident. You know what I'm saying? Snoop was basically naming his top five, you know, and he didn't put Eminem in that top five.
Yeah.
And he wasn't slandering Eminem. He was just saying, look, I'm looking at these MCs of my era and the people who I was influenced by, and, you know, I didn't put him in it.
He's but not my top five from that, either, so.
The reaction from that basically was, okay, you know, they had this little beef, but then they pieced it up and then they did a track together. And that's what the game was trying to do. He was trying to, you know, put that out there. Then maybe they piece it up and maybe they do a track together. And it just didn't, it backfired. It didn't make sense. Like, you should have just got on the phone and talked to Dre, got on the phone and talked to whoever and say, hey, look, you know, let me network with, you know, or build with him and let's do a track together. So it didn't make sense.
All right, so I got you named most of mine on the worst disses. I'm gonna start with the best. To me, my favorite of all time is Common the Bitchin' You. That's my favorite. I think that's the dopest, like the dopest diss record of all time. Now, what do I think is the biggest diss record of all time? Now, that's a different story. I know this might be crazy. I might be going out on a limb with this to some people, but I think the biggest diss record of all time has got to be 50 Cent Wanksta. And this is why. He took a cat that had a top 10 record on radio for 365 days straight and just crushed his career like that. And one of the worst ever is the reply to that, the clapback, Ja Rule. Worst? That's one of the worst ever.
Oh, man. That, I don't know, man.
Clapback is one of the worst beat, ever.
That beat slaps.
I mean,
it didn't get no traction.
From New York, New York, but it's clapback. Siskel and Ebert gives it two thumbs down. But I gotta go with 50 Cent is like the biggest for me because like he literally crushed a career. And then my favorite is, you know, the Common. Now, as far as the worst, one of the worst. Now, you said Cannabis got one of the best, right?
Yeah.
He also got one of the worst with J Clone. And I ain't saying that just because this is live from Fayetteville. This is a Fayetteville show because, you know, good or well, I wasn't defending Cole's apology. You know, I was more on Josie Mo's side with the apology thing. And you and Trill was like, hey, it's cool. He apologized. So I ain't even being biased. It's just, it was whack. The J Clone was whack. Another one, Meek Mill. Want to know.
Was that the one he did the Undertaker?
I think so. He had the Drake sample in there.
Yeah, he had the Undertaker beat and they had to take it down.
Nah, I don't think it's that one. I think it's a different one. But and then I gotta go with probably like Benzino.
Anything by Benzino.
Anything by Benzino has got to be the worst, right? Before we get into the next topic, let's look at some of these comments, though, we got in Reddit. We got, let's see. So we put this main topic in. I didn't do the Scarface one. We got Melly Mel. All right, who had the worst diss record of hip-hop history? Let's see what we got. We didn't do the best. We did the worst. We had Melly Mel, Benzino, the Slim Anus, of course, you said, the Nicki Minaj. A lot of I've seen a few people say Machine Gun Kelly, man, Rap Devil. I'm kind of like on the fences with that. I don't know about that being like the worst diss record of all time.
I think he definitely lost that battle.
Me neither.
But it wasn't the worst.
He definitely lost. Somebody said Tim Dog, Penicillin on Wax. I don't know who he was dissing to that. You had MC Hammer, Benny Siegel, How Can I Kill a Jigga Man? Yeah, I don't even remember it. It was probably...
heard that one. I'd have to go back and listen to that one.
Uncle Luke, it's hard to Uncle say. Luke, Pussy Ass Kid, Pussy and Ho Ass Play, whatever that is. Of course, somebody said Ja Rule Clap Back, another Machine Gun Kelly, Melly Mel. And
Luke this Kid and Play?
I know. Is that who it was? Yeah. You know that was whack.
I remember he dissed Dr. Dre and Cowboys and Compton, but I still like Cowboys and Compton. So
Lloyd Banks, What Goes Up, the track did damage to Murder Inc. So I'm guessing that's one of the best. Big EQ. You remember that one, Lloyd Banks, What Goes Up? Mr. J.
I don't remember that one. I had to go look that one.
And Jones said he was dissing Compton, or all of Compton, Tim Dog was.
Yeah. F. Compton, yeah.
That's where
Dre got back to him on Dre Day.
Before we get to this last topic, we're going to get to a Underground Experience official trailer, and we'll be right back.
It's gone from it being kind of gate kept to being kind of closed off to now it's wide open. You know what I mean? Like from city to city, even state to state, it's wide open. The artists can really control their own destiny now. It really comes down to the business. And we're seeing a lot of the really talented artists in North Carolina really step into their own and create their own lanes and craft their own little niches.
We out here doing what we do, man. You know what I'm saying? Carolina shit. Represent the underground scene. Carolina got a lot to offer. There's a lot of artists out here that y'all sleeping on. You know what I'm saying? Don't say you don't have no talent out here, because if you just stop for a minute, you will see. It's so much talent here. It's so, people got so much to offer. And all we try to do is just bring our talent to the people and bring it to light. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, this is really important that we let the people know, like, Carolina's bigger than J. Cole and the Baby and Petey Pablo.
Thank you. We are back. That was the Underground Music Experience official trailer. And Mr. J, man, that's your baby right there, right?
Yeah, man. We're still working on it. We're still cultivating interviews and getting everything together. Like I said, in the next 2 months, I'm getting ready to start working on basically putting the soundtrack together. So I'll be trying to get back in the studio and trying to get different people together so we can go ahead and get this thing moving. I'm also kind of debating a companion piece as far as a book, because it was basically started from me doing interviews with, you know, hip hop artists from Czechoslovakia to California to the Carolinas. So I may be trying to get a book as a companion piece to that too as well. So we're trying to keep everything moving.
Well, after I did my interview, that's when I decided I had to start working on the No Turning Back documentary. I was just like, yeah, man, I gotta, it's going to take a while. But, you know, I had to record a little piece for that. It's probably like the most vulnerable piece you're ever going to see from me. And then after that, it's no more, you know, and I'm going to get some insight from other people. Just have them come in and like tell like how they met me and just, you know, things about me. All right, so I'm going to play this audio for our next topic. Trill told me to see if I could put the audio, download the audio to play. We got a little Scarface audio. Let's see what we got.
And manipulated and controlled by people that don't look like us.
Yeah. They put your ability Curtis King. To watch to on and show read too. Lyrics behind a paywall.
Ain't no money in the streams for us, but it's money in subscriptions for them.
They got more control over your release date than you do. You ever think about that?
DIY.
DIYers, 7 months ago, when I decided to take my music down from streaming, I got crucified in a way that I had never experienced in my years of being on YouTube. I've made videos that went viral and people were against it. But for some reason, it really struck a chord with people that I said I don't feel like my music should be on streaming because of the devaluing that it represents of the very thing I work so hard on, that I spend so much money on equipment for. But it wasn't until I just could not let the thought go in November of 2023, and I did it. Best decision I made. I went direct to consumer. And in the process of this, I started to see so many of the OGs start to echo the conversation. This is not an I told you so post. This is a I hope that you understand where I was coming from, even if you didn't understand it at the moment. Scarface, legendary Scarface, had an interview recently where he sat down and he kind of expressed some of his issues with streaming and why he feels like certain artists should remove their music from streaming. I didn't think I was going to hear this, but let him cook.
It seems like the whole culture is being dumbed down.
Believe that.
Now, I want to be as offensive as I possibly can when I say this again. The culture is being so dumbed down and manipulated and controlled by people that don't look like us.
Yeah.
All right?
White folks.
So these motherfuckers don't look like me. They're not creators of this culture, but they want to control folks. It.
Believe that.
And dictate who come in, how they come out. The stream, you know, we don't stream, man. We buy records. We ride this shit around in our car.
That's right.
You know what I mean? Like I'm from there, but somebody can take hip hop from us and alienate us from it.
Let that sink in for
white
a second.
Folks.
Somebody gonna have to tell the truth, and I'm gonna tell it.
Let that sink in for a second. It was.
I don't even think I gotta play the whole clip. I mean, I don't know if you want to start.
I'll say it like this. We have to control all the hip hop community has to control all the platforms that we're on. I think the problem becomes taking yourself off something without a plan to build yourself back up. If you already have something like Curtis King has, he already has a platform where he's going straight to consumer. He's able to talk to people and let people know about what he's doing. Then it's an easier transition for him than it would be another artist. My issue or my thing is never take yourself away from something, always add something to you. Like you need to be here and there also. You need to be everywhere plus, plus, plus. You can't eliminate avenues. You need to be creating more avenues. I think a lot of times artists kind of shoot themselves in the foot by not having physical merchandise, physical CDs. People, you know, I think the biggest part of what happened to music and where it became more alienated and more disposable is when people went straight to just digital. Everything's digital. Now you can just basically delete something because you don't feel like hearing it right now. Or even if you do feel like hearing it, you might accidentally delete it. Now you got to go back and buy it again. When the entertainment community, when the corporate entities made sure you couldn't own something or made it almost make it look like it's clowned out to own physical things, that's where we got into trouble. You know what I'm saying? You don't have DVDs, you don't have CDs, you know, on that level anymore. People go, well, why you got that CD? Why you got that DVD? Why you got this? Because people can take their stuff off of streaming, or they can shut a platform down, or they can say, you know, we're not streaming this until you pay this new price. Now it's more than you were paying for it before, but the value isn't there. So, I mean,
All right, so I thought about this long and hard, man. I want to touch on a few things. Okay, you said the value. Well, streaming has definitely devalued the music. Once you put it on the streaming platforms, you have devalued it. Just because what they're paying out, just based off the payouts, is devalued. And like Barry said, man, the problem, 100,000 songs a day, man, that's a crazy oversaturation. So once you put it on the streaming platforms, yes, it loses value on that platform. Then I want to tackle like what he said, the people that are taking control of the art that don't look like him. He's talking about white folks, but those are the white folks that don't look like me either. You get what I'm saying? Like, they don't look like me either. They look different. These are white folks that look different from me. So these are the wrong kind of white. These are not the Steve Rifkin white folks, as I would like to say. The Rick Rubin white folks running, you know, hip hop and rap music nowadays.
Yeah, what Dave Chappelle would call the Tiki Torch whites.
So yeah, these white folks, they don't even look like me. You know what I'm saying? They don't dress like me. They don't talk like me. They don't think like me. They don't act like me. They don't care about hip hop one bit. They have no attachment to it. They just want to make money off of it, and they don't care if it is just all negative hip hop, no positive. They don't care if the genre drives itself in the ground or what. They don't care about none of that. Now, to the streaming part, man, I've been thinking about this. Now, I'm a guy, man, I've been doing music promo for 13 years now, man, and I make a lot of my living off of, you know, Spotify playlist pitching. As Barry was saying, like, you know, he does Apple, Pandora, and Amazon Music, and when he needs Spotify, he comes to me, you know. I've been saying Spotify, I didn't feel like it was going to last. Because I knew that the streaming companies won't really make a profit. Like, see, the CEOs are making a profit. Is this what people don't understand? You can have businesses where the CEOs making profits, but the business is not making a profit.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? So that's what Spotify is. Because when two-thirds of your net or gross income is going to somebody else, that's not a lot of, you got peanuts left to play with, because you still got to pay it. They still got to pay out Joe Rogan for podcasts, all these other podcasters, all these unsigned and independent artists with these micro payments. You know, it's a lot of money they're paying out every single day. So I felt like, hey, Spotify's not going to last anyways. But this is what I've come to the conclusion of. I think it's best for like people to do like a Curtis King and just build a specific fan base at first before you even go to the streaming side. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah.
That's what I think. I think they need to wait till they get to a certain, because if not, unless you got some kind of advertising budget or marketing budget, you're just uploading your song in a pool of 100,000 other songs that are just swimming through the Spotify oceans every single day. At the end of the week, that's 700,000 songs. I mean, that's another reason why Cat Like NBA YoungBoy and a lot of these rappers have to be considered content creators nowadays, because they pump out so much music that it only has a week shelf life, I'm guessing, at most.
And to your point, you know what I'm saying? The issue is you have whole ecosystem. You know what I'm saying? You got studio heads or people who still have, you know, studios outside of their home. You know what I'm saying? Who are pushing people to put out more content to keep the lights on at the studio. You got, you know, a whole ecosystem of different lawyers and other people who still trying to eat off of this, especially now even more because some of these labels have closed down. They've laid people off. So now they're trying to figure out ways to get people to keep pumping out music, keep putting
Then you got
out.
The music video guy, like you got to buy the music video for the song that you recorded over there at, you know, with Barry at Red Room or something, you know, and that's the thing. Even a cat like Barry Williams at Red Room will tell you, I mean, you still got to have marketing. Regardless, right. Whether you go to him to pay for the song, the recording, and go to somebody for the music video. That's why, you know, like Wendy Day is saying, like, you don't spend an arm and a leg and a kidney and a liver on a music video. You spend about $500 at most on a music video. And then, you know, if the song starts to take off, then you go and like, hey, let's go do the 2.0 version where we put like, you know, $2,000 into the music video or whatever, you know.
I think a lot of times, you know, people don't think about that. They don't think about their audience. They don't think about exactly where they're trying to put it at. I mean, I'm basically on TuneCore with my label. You know,
I got TuneCore and CD Baby.
Re-releasing things, you know, from time to time.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm steering it to lanes and places where I know people will go to it. Most other people are not steering it to that lane. They just put it out there. They done a whole mixtape in 24 hours and then just put it on the site. And then they think they're supposed to be, you know, automatically superstars in 48 hours. And like I said, I've said it time and time again, you know, different places. That's just not how that works.
Well, this is what made me look at the digital distribution different after watching this video. I started thinking, like, in the 90s, when we were trying to get on, if you wanted distribution, what did you have to have? You had to have a record deal.
Yeah.
You had to have a record, whether it was a major label or independent that was under a major label, you had to have a record deal. Or if not, you was too short and it out the trunk, right?
Exactly.
That was it. Too short out the trunk, or you had to have a record label deal. Independent or major, and then you had distribution. Now, we've convinced people that you don't need no kind of situation, no kind of rollout when you distribute music. Just throw it out. Just throw it out there. Just put it out there. Pray, you know, who knows? Somebody might listen to it, and you might be signed. That the last artist I can think of that got signed off of one song alone. One song alone. Who do you think I'm gonna name?
I would probably think about the last person I could think of is Tekashi. That's the last person I could think of.
Who?
Last person I can think of is Tekashi.
He got signed off of one song only.
I think so.
I think the last person I could think of, did he come out before Bobby Smurda?
Yeah, I think he was out before. I think he was either
Bobby,
out.
I think Bobby Smurda kind of got signed off of one song
around the same time.
But let me tell you, a cat that got signed off of one song and it wasn't a hit. See, those cats got signed off of, they had hit records or popping records, right? And then they got signed. Same thing with like Lil Pump, you know what I'm saying? But J. Cole got signed off of a song that wasn't a hit. He got signed. Like, that's the last cat I remember to get signed off of, like, the demo shit. You know what I'm saying? Somebody just hearing your shit with no fan base. Nobody really know who you. I didn't know who J. Cole was when he came out because I didn't know the. I didn't put the face with the name at first. I knew Therapist. That's all I knew. And then when I seen the picture, I was like, oh, that's Therapist.
And, you know, he had a lot of motion. He had, you know, the mixtape with DJ On Point. He had kind of a little bit of stuff going on with, you know,
Yeah, but I heard Jay. I heard Jay-Z heard the Lights Please and was like, yeah, I want to sign this cat. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but I could see that happening. Like, especially that record at that time, The Lights Please.
Yeah, it was definitely
It was a really good record at that time. It was a really dope record.
And I think it stood out from everything that was coming out.
It did, especially at that time. It really did. And the fact that he produced the record, just the concept of it, everything, I think it really stood out. But since then, it's like the last of a dying breed, man, to get signed off. Because Kendrick was signed with TDE on that record with Lil Wayne and J-Rock. He did the hook. So he had to grind with TDE for a while. And then when Dre signed him, that's when it kind of boosted up. The Dollar and the Dream days, Grown Simba. Yeah, that was some really good records right there. The Dollar and the Dream, Grown Simba. That was some really good records early on, man.
Yeah.
Nobody was putting out records like that on a mainstream scale at all in hip hop at that specific time, man. Like the sound, it kind of just died out. And Jay-Z, he bet on the right horse, man, I have to say. He bet on the right horse. I mean, besides Kanye, J. Cole is the biggest rap artist that Jay-Z has ever signed.
Definitely. I think, you know, he kind of knows who to attach himself to at the right times to kind of make sure he's still, you know, in everybody's ear and in everybody's thoughts as far as music is concerned. I think he knew exactly that this was going to be the next movement. I think he's one of those guys who kind of knows, you know, how to maneuver himself. And once he sees something, he's going to make sure it takes off.
Well, Trailer Noise missed another Friday. I don't know if we told. Did we tell him the rules? I guess. Hold up. Let me ask you this: If you miss a Friday and you make a Saturday, I mean, what I say the rule was three straight episodes you miss, you out. Wasn't that the rule I had?
Something like that.
Now, if you make a Friday and you miss a Friday and make the Saturday, that's not really cassette. You missing two straight, right?
No, I guess it's one and a half, something like that.
Yeah, so we can't really count it. Okay, so Trill's good to go. Trill, you ain't going to be kicked off the Fridays. Don't worry about it. But if you didn't come on Saturdays, you only came on Fridays, you missed two straight Fridays. By the third, man, we'd have to boot you, man. That's been the rule since day one. I made that rule a long time ago. Like, you missed three episodes straight. You got to go. Jones knows that. Jones is tuned in. You know that's been the rule since day one. Jones is an original member. And who knows? Jones might be back on the show sometime soon. But he's camera shy.
He had a spot taken by Lil Yachty.
He had his spot taken by a Lil Yachty who we kicked off the show.
Immediately after he got off.
Immediately after, yeah, we kicked Lil Yachty off the show immediately after he replaced Jones. Like, I was like, hell no, we ain't going for that. Well, we about to call it another episode. Any shout-outs you want to do, Jay?
Yeah, shout-outs to BTS. I'm going to get back with y'all, man. We getting ready to go in the studio at some point and put something down.
Well, you and Kenny Mac?
Fat. I got his track too, Fat. I'm getting ready to knock yours out too, man. Getting ready to do some things. So, you know, I've been itching to try to get back into the studio, but you know, dealing with this budgeting out for the documentary and trying to keep up with some other things, man, is definitely kind of sidelined some stuff. So we getting ready to put some things in motion. So we can get this music out, get these soundtracks going, get these other interviews done, and put this documentary to bed so we can get on to some other business.
I want to say shouts out to Barry Benson. Shouts out to Big EQ and Jones for tuning in. I forgot to say another name that we got coming on the show recently, here soon. Shouts out to UG, Cellar Dwellers. We got him coming on. Can't wait for that one. And shouts out to Chris Roker for introducing me to Barry Benson. That's my Dizzle guy. And shouts out, Jones said, yo, Jay, have you built with Dirty Den? Just wondering. And I'm familiar with Dirty Den. Dirty Den was on one of my mixtapes. Like, maybe the first, he might have been on the First in Flight mixtape. I think he was on that one. I don't know. I got to go back and check. Well, once again, thank y'all for tuning in. Another episode live from Fayette 9 Fridays. Don't forget tomorrow, Saturday, 5 p.m. Eastern, we'll be doing live music reviews with me and Trilla Noise Tracks. We don't got no interviews tomorrow, so, man, I mean, it's up to you if you want to come on tomorrow, Jay, but yeah, we ain't got no interviews locked in. We'll just be reviewing music. But I think the week after we got, I don't know if we got somebody the week after. I know we got Smooth Hustler coming up one of these Saturdays, and we got UG from Cellar Dwellers one of these Saturdays, too. I got to check the dates.
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to be trying to tap in on those days. I've been running kind of busy on some of these days. So,
I know how it is, man.
Documentary. Moving.
Well, check us out. Friday, 7 p.m. Saturdays, 5 p.m. Eastern time. Peace. We out.
Beats by Trill, straight Killerville, dog.